the remaining stairs towards him and took it. PPE, third year. Where were you at school? She was bemused. Liverpool, she said. He raised an eyebrow. I meant, which school? A pause. I was at Eton. She felt like laughing. He was kidding. Really? It was the best she could manage, and she hated herself for not coming up with a proper put-down, something that would nail him firmly in his place. Rarely, he said, though it sounded like rarely, a different word entirely from her guttural intonation that rose up with its second syllable, and which she realized now she might have to abandon. His long vowel stretched through the silence as she thought of something to say. Anyway, he rescued her. What's your name, dear neighbour? Holly, she said, bracing herself for the inevitable Holly Berry. You are joking. No. She was used to this reaction. Used, too, to trotting out the same embarrassing explanation. I was conceived on Christmas Eve. My dad has a sense of humour. Or likes to think he has, anyway. His smile widened, and he threw back his head, like that father in the quad below. Perhaps it was him she'd spied. Well, it's certainly memorable, Holly Berry. Are you prickly? I can be. Was that the best he could do? Her childhood's worth of taunt surfaced, but her tongue lay fat in her mouth, incapable of forming a better retort. Blood flushed up her neck as the silence yawned between them, exposing her gaucheness. She needed to say something, anything to wipe that smirk off his face. He gave her that smile again, a wide, languorous grin from a boy who knew he had the world at his feet. Though he wasn't all that. Manda, who was experienced, or more experienced than her, wouldn't look at him twice with that shaggy mop of hair. She liked her men, and they were men, to look neat. But then Manda would never apply to Oxford. Why would I want to go somewhere stuck up like that? She'd asked Holly, whom she also viewed as stuck up. She wanted to go to Manchester, and had started a BTEC in business studies at the local sixth form college. Studying English, reading English, whatever that meant, was a waste of time. Far better to start earning straight away, or do something vocational, something that you knew would make you money. Holly wasn't preoccupied with making money. She was reading English because it was the subject she was good at. Exceptional, her A-level teacher had said, before suggesting to her mum that she might apply for Oxford. Some of the colleges are becoming aware that they need to be diverse about their intake. I really think she has a chance, Mrs. Thorogood had explained. She had got into her first choice college, a choice she had made because it looked particularly pretty in the prospectus and was central and close to the libraries. Though she'd realised the percentage of freshers from a state school like hers would be low, it hadn't occurred to her that she might meet someone like Ned. She had heard of Eton, of course, but only in the way that she had heard of the House of Commons or Buckingham Palace. And now she had an old Etonian as a neighbour. She needed to find someone more normal, more like herself. For though she had wanted to come to Oxford, to leave her old life behind, now she craved someone familiar. "Is there anyone else on this staircase?" she said. Alison Jessop wasn't on her staircase, it transpired, nor was she reading English. But Holly gravitated towards her as inevitably as an iron filing drawn by a magnet's strength. It was her laugh that caught her attention. A warm, full-bellied sound coming from this small, pretty girl, flicking her hair and beaming up at a boy on the other side of the dining hall across two rows of dark tables. Above her hung heavy oils of notable alumni, an Archbishop of Canterbury, a Prime Minister, a Nobel Prize-winning novelist, and an actor. Either side of her were earnest boys, her fellow mathematicians, Holly later learned, with the pale complexions and pustules, the lank, greased hair of those who spent too much time in the library. Alison, with her guttural laugh and hot pink top beneath her short black gown, provided a blast of colour, a hint of glamour against the sombre wooden panels and gloom of a hall lit by flickering candelabras. She was from Leeds, her accent more muted than Holly's, generically northern to the southerners around them with their rarelys and their awfullys and their A's that were lingered over, warm and indulgent compared to Holly and Alison's A's, which were flat and short. She had gone to a private school, and so could have fitted in, but she played up her northernness, didn't see it as the badge of shame that Holly feared. "Nowt like pie and gravy," she would say in a parody of the flat-capped pigeon fancier others assumed her to be, as they queued together in the canteen the next day. Or as she demolished the plate of food with a gutsiness that suggested she was ready to attack her life here at Oxford with the same enthusiasm. It should have grated. Perhaps would have, if she'd been thick-set and crop-haired like Holly, or if she had looked as if she had a whippet chained up in the quad. But Alison looked as if she was born to wear a cocktail dress. Her face was angelic, heart-shaped with big blue eyes and a cupid's bow of a mouth, from which an unlit cigarette often hung, the crumpled packet stuffed in her back pocket. Her subject should have marked her out as uncool, but her contradictions, that exquisite face with its dirty laugh, the dry subject with the vivacious girl, were beguiling, and she seemed to like Holly. "Thank fuck I've found you," she declared, at the end of their first evening together, with a passionate ferocity that tended to characterise friendships in that first week, alliances that many spent the next term, perhaps the next year, trying to wriggle out of. She downed her snake bite and black. "Time for another." Having Alison as a friend meant that Oxford seemed suddenly more manageable, the social side at least. The academic side didn't sound as if it would be too difficult. They were doing the medieval paper this term, and Victorian literature. An author a week, Hardy, Eliot, Pater, the Brontes, Charlotte and Emily, Tennyson, Browning, Wilde, Dickens, the latter given 2 weeks in a rare concession to the volume of his work. Reading the novels she hadn't devoured before she arrived was achievable, as was constructing the essays, for she was organised and systematic, working long hours and keeping to a realistic timetable for when she would need to start work on her weekly essay. 8 p.m, the night before a tutorial scheduled first thing the next day. There was a maturity to the way she studied, honed during the past few years at school when her peers shunned her and books were her comfort and her escape route from their sustained bullying. But navigating her way socially was far more tricky. And yet it needn't be, for now she had Alison, whom she might have found intimidating were it not for the shared geography which bound them, Yorkshire and Merseyside blanketed together as being part of a vast, unknowable, grim up-northness, the two of them black sheep in a uniform flock of white. Of course there were others who stood apart from the mass of hearty public school southerners, the overtly camp guy who left to go to Bristol at the end of his first year, a token Asian mathematician, but they squirreled themselves away. These boys kept themselves apart from those who slipped from libraries to bars to bedrooms, from tutorials to dining halls, and out into the crisp, moonlit nights. They would emerge, blinking for their exams, but otherwise lived in the alternative universe of the college computer room, where they found friends in similar rooms in other universities through the magic of internet message boards. But Holly and Alison were different. Female, for one thing, in a world in which their relative rarity in a male-dominated college made them interesting, and in Alison's case at least, not socially inept. By virtue of her association with her funny, mouthy friend, Holly could navigate life at college and ride on her coattails, at least for a while. The Saturday of their first week, the improbably named Nortth Week, and the noise from the cellar bar flowed out into the quad from the bottom of the staircase. A deep-bottomed, rich male laughter topped with something high-pitched and over-effusive, the sound of girls wanting to fit in. The stairs down to the bar dripped with condensation, the moisture from more than 80 students breathing in the same stale air. Holly pushed her way in behind Alison and was thrust against the damp back of a young man, T-shirt drenched in sweat. His buttocks, in jeans, were hot against her skin. 2 snake bite and blacks, please, Alison called to the barman, an unshaven, disarmingly good-looking thirdier. She reached into her cleavage and retrieved a crumpled fiver, shoved the £3 change he gave her into a pocket of her jeans. The floor was sweet and sticky, and Holly felt nauseous as she moved through the tight-packed, pulsating bodies, the conversation ebbing and flowing, then building to a roar. This part of the bar was thick with smoke, wreathing from the mouths of Ned Iddesleigh Flight, who gave her an ironic nod, and a group of third-year men, each dressed in a uniform of shirts, rolled at the cuffs and half-pulled from jeans that hung low at their waists, revealing a hint of a Calvin Klein waistband. Ned had a piece of string twisted around one hairy wrist. They pushed on deeper into the bar, into the furthest section beyond the pool table. It was late. They'd just made last orders, Holly insisting on working in the college library before Alison, bemused by her behaviour. "You don't need to be such a spod," had dragged her down here. The students in this dark part of the bar had had a long night. She slipped on a slick of cider and jarred her hip on the edge of a dark wooden table, was briefly befuddled as someone grabbed her elbow and righted her with a casual arm thrown around her waist. "It's a little fresher. Easy does it," went his cry, and she felt her body stiffen against the fluid brush of his fingers, the quick squeeze that she knew meant no harm but was still a surprise. "Fuck a fresher," the mantra she'd heard bandied around in the dining room as the second years had assessed the newcomers filled her head. She glanced at the boy. Was that what he wanted? But he'd already released her and was downing a pint, head tilted back, Adam's apple bobbing as the golden liquid slipped down his gullet. She watched, fascinated, the memory of his fingers imprinted on her waist. "Come on, you'll miss the action," Alison was calling back to her and thrust out a hand, the fingers square with chipped fuchsia nails. Holly took it and allowed herself to be pulled along in her slipstream, jostled and hustled through the crowd. "You all right?" Alison called back, her face flushed with excitement, gleaming with a sheen of sweat. She nodded, forcing down any misgivings and giving in to a flicker of excitement building inside her, the sense that something new, and possibly illicit, was about to happen, for there was definitely something going on in the furthest corner of this stretch of the cellar bar. A crowd was gathered facing the wall, shielding a table, and a mantra was building. "Roscoe! Roscoe! Roscoe! Roscoe!" The boy's name was being chanted, and then there was a drumming of several pairs of hands on the table, and a great cheer erupted, a brutal cry of delight at the breaking of some final taboo. "Fuck's sake!" The boy Roscoe staggered up and away. "I need some beer." His broad, pleasant face was flushed as he shoved past on his way to the bar, but behind his beam she sensed some embarrassment, though perhaps it was just the effect of the drink, held high and sloshed back from a plastic pint cup. "Gizago!" Another boy, broad-chested as the first, called out, and his request was met with a rallying cheer. "Andy! Andy! Andy!" The chanting resumed as the boy was thrust through his friends and hauled up onto the table. He looked around, grinning, delighted at being cheered by his teammates, for they were members of the college rugby team, she saw as she took in their tops emblazoned with their initials and the college crest. "Andy! Andy! Andy! Andy!" And then, as he lowered himself to lie down, his back on the table, "Go on, my boy!" She watched, curious at first, then bewildered, and then appalled, as another member of the rugby team pulled down his jeans and boxer shorts and positioned himself on all fours above the laughing Andy. "Salisbury!" The roar rose up as a third boy stood on a bench with a pint of beer and poured it down Salisbury's naked buttocks and into poor Andy's mouth. "Andy! Andy! Andy!" The drumming of the table almost drowned out the calls, but then there was a jubilant roar, and he was heaving himself off the table, spitting beer and demanding a refill, while the half-naked Salisbury, who'd clambered off him, hauled his jeans and boxers up. "Fuck's sake!" Andy half-spat his beer. "Fucking gross! Any more takers?" The ringleader, the lad pouring the pint of beer, looked round, and to Holly's bemusement, another rugby player, chest puffed out, hips rocking in a parody of a cowboy swaggering towards a fight, took Salisbury's place. "What are they doing? Why are they doing this?" The words slipped out as she glanced at the flushing Andy, whose neck was caught in a headlock by other team members. They slapped his back as they thrust him towards the bar. "They're anal chugging," Alison shouted in her ear. "It's what the rugby boys do." "What?" "I know. That lad, the one standing up's a scholar. I saw his gown at dinner. He's supposed to be super bright." She raised her eyebrows, then turned back. Holly watched the boy Alison was talking about as he stood above his teammates, one hand tipping a plastic pint of beer, the other on his hips, as though he were a farmer presenting his best beast at a show. His face, on top of a thick neck, seemed free of malice, dark eyes glinting below a floppy fringe that was damp with sweat. Pink lips, with perfect teeth, parted as he poured the amber beer, then threw back his head and gave a roar. Disappointment weighed heavy in her chest, like a physical pain. These were supposed to be the brightest brains of her generation. Oxford, the place where she thought she might discuss philosophy or politics, where she'd rant against John Major's government, not watch broad-shouldered lads with plummy accents drink beer from each other's cracks. "Mad, isn't it?" Alison grinned at her and rolled her eyes, but there was nothing in her reaction to suggest that she was repulsed, more that she was intrigued by this aspect of student life. Andy, the second boy to take part, was by her side now, she realised, released from the throng and trying to meld into the back of the crowd. He was drinking determinedly, eyes fixed on the middle distance as he downed his beer, huge shoulders hunched forward as if to minimise his presence. She caught his eye and tried to convey her sympathy. He looked away, but not before she saw him flush. Chapter 9, Autumn 1992. Sophie Greenaway curled her legs beneath her in the capacious armchair and smiled at Dr. Howard Blackburn, the renowned medieval English scholar, as she looked up from the essay she was reading aloud. It was the second week of Michaelmas, and Holly watched their tutor watch the other girl, saw his eyes follow the easy flick of those legs in their black opaque tights as they crossed and uncrossed, then languidly rearranged themselves, her feet tucked underneath her bottom. Most of the week, Sophie wore rowing skins, the regulation navy and pale blue kit which marked her out as a member of the college women's first boat, but not, it would seem, for Howard's tutorials. For those, it was a short tartan mini, loafers, and opaque tights. She was reading about courtly love, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. The concept of loving with no expectation of consummation, of admiring from afar, of humiliating oneself in the adoration of a fair lady, and risking her disdain or disapproval to prove one's chivalry, one's essential knightliness. Sophie's essay wasn't particularly illuminating. Holly could detect nothing that she hadn't read herself in the York notes she had skimmed through before turning to C.S. Lewis and A.C. Spearing, nor was it in any way elegantly written. It was a solid essay, what she would later know as beta-minus material, but that didn't matter. What mattered to Holly was that Sophie looked as if she was the sort of woman who, 6 centuries earlier, would have noble knights falling at her feet. While Holly would be a peasant, Sophie would be on the receiving end of courtly love. She recrossed her legs, and Holly was entranced. While Alison was pretty, Sophie had a different quality to her, a type of beauty that looked as if it had evolved through the generations. Or perhaps her ancestors had been consciously bred to look like this. For hers was a look that belonged to a certain class. Legs that were effortlessly thin, even at her upper thighs. Delicate bones and arched brows. And thick, dark hair that she flicked, to Holly's irritation, from side to side. Her eyes were a startling blue, and so wide that she could use them to obvious effect, as she was doing now, to suggest innocence or incomprehension. If Holly had had to describe her in a single word, she would have picked classy. But that was the type of word her dad would use. It didn't come close to capturing the essence of her. Holly found it incongruous that they had been paired up like this for the term, among the seven students reading English in their year at Shrewsbury College. Medieval literature with Dr. Blackburn, and then the Anglo-Saxon translation class. Sitting in Howard's study, she felt exposed. Her DMs were planted on the carpet between two piles of books that teetered like all the other piles in the room, those crammed on coffee tables or perched on the edge of the bookshelves that ran the height and breadth of one wall. She shifted back into the armchair, loosely covered in a plain, worn velvet. The fabric was soft beneath her fingers, and she stroked it, eyes flickering from the books to the vast windows opening onto the quad, motes of dust floating in the sunshine, to the gaze of her tutor, a quizzical smile on his face as he watched Sophie's legs crossing and uncrossing once more.
"And what about you? Do you agree with Sophie's interpretation of Sir Gawain's motives?"
Dr. Blackburn dragged his eyes from her tutorial partner and fixed them on her. And suddenly, Holly found her voice. She spoke of Sir Gawain's conflict between chivalry and desire, and, as she gained confidence, she could sense that not only was Dr. Blackburn looking at her with more interest.
"That's an unusual interpretation, but I like it."
But that Sophie, her beta-minus essay forgotten, was sitting up and joining in, was forcing herself to think beyond the pass note she'd copied. Verbatim, perhaps. In any case, the attention was collegiate, not unfriendly, and when they left the tute, as she found herself now calling it, it seemed natural that the two of them would have a cup of tea together in the tea bar. Besides, Sophie said she had a proposition for her. The plan was that they would divide up the Anglo-Saxon translations and take it in turns to research the bulk of the medieval English essays. Sophie had a lever-arch file of notes, given to her by an accommodating second year whom she'd plied with drink the week before.
"Are you sure that's all you had to do?"
Holly didn't mean to sound intrusive, and yet this goodwill seemed excessive.
"Holly, what are you implying?" Sophie gave her a knowing smile. "He doesn't need these essays any more. And he said he knew what a bore the medieval paper is. God, we've so much to read for the Victorians that we're not going to be able to cover them properly unless we're efficient about handling our workload. Look, here's one on the Pearl Poet. I can plunder that for next week. And then, can you read the Mallory?"
"I think Le Morte d'Arthur's quite important. We should probably both read it, shouldn't we?"
"Oh, bugger that. Life's too short, honestly. I want to try for the women's lightweights, and I won't have the time if I'm going to do the Victorians properly. If you could read the Mallory and fill me in, I'll do the rest from pass notes."
"Well, okay. And I'll do my share of the Beowulf translation, I promise."
"Oh, look, though." She gave a cheeky grin. "John's given me his translation here."
"Isn't this cheating?"
Sophie looked at her askance and smiled, though not unkindly.
"Not at all. It's about being efficient. Everyone does it. I just thought..."
And she almost stumbled on the words as she realised they sounded so gauche.
"I thought that doing the translations and reading English literature from the start was important for our understanding of its development. I thought reading the whole canon was what this degree was all about."
"Well, if you want to spend time translating Beowulf, you do so."
Sophie took a swig of tea, but she seemed more amused than irritated.
"I don't think my doing so will make a jot of difference to my marks or to my university experience, apart from reducing the time when I could do other things."
"Such as?"
Holly wondered aloud.
"Oh, you know, rowing, and then... She gave a jubilant laugh. That's what uni's about. Having fun, making contacts, doing sport. An extension of school, in a way.
Holly shrugged. Her school hadn't been like that at all.
My father always says you should assess the validity of any investment before deciding on the amount you invest.
Oh, what does he do, your father?
He's an investment banker. And yours?
Holly's heart sank. She should have seen that coming.
A teacher.
Which subject?
Cars. He's a driving instructor.
It would have been better if she'd been honest from the start.
How sweet and useful.
I suppose so. I don't drive.
Didn't he teach you? Or did it lead to arguments?
No, he's not around much. My parents split up.
It felt strange to unburden herself like this. To divulge so much information in one whoosh when she was essentially quite private. But this seemed to be the way at uni, she was discovering. Close friendships were being forged at a fevered rate, as if the brevity of the terms, 8 or 9 weeks, meant the usual cautious way in which relationships developed had to be abandoned and the process speeded up.
God, I wish mine would sometimes.
Sophie put her hand to her mouth as if the words had slipped out without her meaning to.
Oops, forget I said that, I didn't mean it.
Really? Holly was interested. Perhaps Sophie's life wasn't as perfect as it seemed.
Oh, just, you know, bit of a philanderer. Men, eh?
Sophie gathered her books together and thrust them into a bag, then picked the lever arch file of notes off the table and hugged it tight to her chest. The opportunity for sharing secrets seemed to have been slammed tight shut, and the smile Sophie wore now was fixed, with none of the joyfulness of a few minutes earlier. Holly, gathering her notes together, took her lead from her.
"Yes, men,"
she said, as if she knew all about them, instead of still being a virgin who'd only just turned 18. She ruffled her hair and pulled her baggy jumper over her jeans, a means of making herself blend into the background, or at least of being sexually invisible, and followed her new friend out of the tea room and into the soft autumnal sunshine outside. That first term at Oxford was an education, not just in the texts of the Pearl Poet and Malory, in the poetry of Christina Rossetti and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, but in life, or the very real possibility of a different life. Looking back, it was as if her 18 years had offered her just one version, and the old certainties, the food she ate, the way she talked, the way people thought, could be taken apart and reassembled so that life became brighter and harder, more textured and complex than ever before. Later, she would remember that autumn term as a relentless feasting of her senses, a daily bombardment of new sights and smells and sounds that sometimes felt exhausting, so extensively did they challenge what she had once known. This newness was everywhere. She could be wandering through Christchurch meadows and see a cow staring at her through the dense November mist, its huge head contemplative and mournful. For, of course, students could keep longhorn cattle on the meadows and had been doing so since the 15th century. Would run back over Merton Street's cobbles and be surprised by a bowler-hatted porter, or a couple of boys, inexplicably in tails, staggering back to college, arms around each other's shoulders like the most amorous of lovers, an empty bottle in their hands. She could duck into the labyrinthine-covered market and be surprised by the ripe reek of fresh meat and the sight of a deer hanging upside down by its haunches, perfect apart from the neat shot to its head. And then she would see the same species in a deer park in the centre of this city hours later, flitting dewy-eyed and fearful. That Michaelmas term was partly characterised by food. Jacket potatoes in polystyrene boxes oozing butter and baked beans, and bought from the kebab van on the high street when she missed hall, as she soon learnt to call dinner. Vast quantities of lasagna and garlic bread shovelled down by the rugger boys and boaties, and by her and Ally, as autumn crept on and the nights turned cold. Steaming mugs of tea and toasted sandwiches in the college tea room or the Queen's Lane tea shop where you perched on stools and people watched through windows wet with condensation. Venison and port consumed for the first time at a formal hall. So delicious she tried to steal the wine in a crystal decanter, being stopped by a college servant and having it removed ever so gently from her hand. There was a new language to be learnt. Tutes for tutorials, battles, the bills for each term, mods, first-year exams, subfusc, the black and white dress worn for formal occasions, collections, the exams at the start of each term, exhibitioners, students who gained first-class marks in their yearly exam, scholars who achieved this in subsequent years, a new academic terminology to understand, Marxist theory, feminist theory, as well as the lists of the critics she would be reading and the lecturers she would be listening to. She bought postcards of the dreaming spires from Blackwell's and propped them on the mantelpiece above her fire. Blue-tacked a large print of Klimt's The Kiss in her bedroom, drawn by the opulence of the gold leaf and the quiet knowledge of being loved that played across the woman's face. Because it was what she thought she should do, she invested in a college scarf, a thick navy and pink weight of wool that she thought looked pretentious, tossed over one shoulder, and instead wound round and round her neck so that she breathed into it as she blew out and became snugly hot. She did not join the Oxford Union, the debating ground for past prime ministers and political leaders, and the environment where future politicians gathered in their mustard cords and tweed jackets. Young men, and they were invariably men, aping the behaviour of older ones. She began to shed her baggy jumpers and started to wear hoodies, to try leggings with her trusty DMs, though her thighs were still wide and cumbersome compared to her friends. Her glasses, dark-rimmed NHS ones, were hidden when she wasn't in the library, and she experimented with Kohl pencil, heavily applied at the corner of her eyes. She joined the student paper and began to review student drama, attended meetings of the Student Labour Party, and volunteered for the telephone counselling service, Nightline. She marched, angrily, to reclaim the streets, holding her rape alarm tight, as if Oxford's potential rapists were primed at any point to pounce. After a couple of weeks, she stopped carrying it, for her world of the Quad and the High Street, the pubs and the faculty, seemed so safe, so cosseted, compared to anything she'd experienced back home, that it felt like an affectation. Besides, although in a college with a mere 18 girls in her year, she received little male attention. Ned would offer an ironic grin. The two boys reading English in her year would be perfectly friendly, but no one appeared to be interested in her sexually. Why would they, when there were the likes of Alison, who spent her nights drinking or clubbing, or Sophie, the epitome of an athletic young woman to try their chances on? It didn't bother her, or she told herself it didn't, and her passion was channeled into her close female friendships. The bond with Alison, so different from her in so many ways, grew stronger the night she found her slumped unconscious on the toilet after a heavy session in the bar. It was she who held Alison's long blonde hair back as her friend vomited into the pan, she who wiped her mouth with a paper towel and brought her a glass of water, who splashed her face as tenderly as a mother would a child, and half carried, half guided her back to her bedroom, who sat up with her that night, terrified she would choke if she didn't keep watch. Alison's jeans had been pulled down when she'd found her there, and there had been something so vulnerable about her being so exposed like this. "What if one of the lads had found me?" her friend wondered later. "They'd have been embarrassed." "Well, yes, but what if anything had happened?" "Nothing would have happened. You weren't in a fit state to do anything, and you were about to throw up." "I don't know." Alison had chewed at a cuticle, and Holly noticed that her once neat nails were becoming bitten down, the quicks ragged. She gave a hard, bright laugh. "Not sure everyone would be put off by that." If this bonded them, the more confident girl becoming more noticeably appreciative, the relationship equaling out a little, then it was through their Anglo-Saxon studies that she grew closer to Sophie. Every Wednesday they would sit together in the college library swapping halves of translation and laboriously copying them from each other before Sophie found a photocopier and so cut their sessions short. Holly would watch her friend from the opposite side of the desk and wonder if her hair would grow that thick if she abandoned her masculine crop and how she could make her caterpillar eyebrows as elegant and refined. And what about her dress sense? Sophie wore short skirts or Levi's, if not in rowing kit, and Holly wondered if a pair of these, though way beyond her budget, would somehow make her legs look longer, or give her that elusive status, mark her out as being cool. She would watch Sophie's looping writing, a swirl of purple ink spiralling from a fountain pen across lined A4, and compare it favourably to her own biroed mass of letters. Holly's work was neat. Post-its, fluorescent marker pens, a ring binder with different sections demarcated by card and plastic files that could be reinserted. She was a stationery junkie. But her actual handwriting was a scrawl. It was as if there were so many ideas inside her head that they fought against each other to get onto the paper. A flurry of jumbled letters, a witch's hand or a substandard clerk's, was the result. That hour spent comparing translations, checking each other understood what the Green Knight was doing at a certain point, or whether they could discuss it convincingly, was one of the highlights of Holly's week. Before now, her cleverness had been a mark of shame, something she was secretly proud of, but which she knew she shouldn't advertise, not even here, where there was currency in suggesting that you crammed for your chutes. A week of work concertinaed into a few twilight hours. But Sophie was frank in her appreciation of Holly's hard work, for invariably she did the lion's share, Sophie popping a note in her pigeonhole the day before, admitting that the early mornings spent rowing were taking a toll on her, and she hadn't quite found the time to manage her half. "Oh, you are clever," she would tell her repeatedly, "not like thicky old me." "Come off it. You're not thick. A solid Desmond, my father thinks." "A 2-2," Holly translated. "Well, that's okay." "Exactly. Far better to enjoy myself. A solid degree, a rowing blue and a nice chap. Hopefully a future husband. That's what I want to get out of being here." Holly leaned back. There were so many parts of that sentence that were foreign to her. So many that struck her as completely wrong. And yet she couldn't help but smile at Sophie's frankness. There was something so uncomplicated about her. This fresh-faced girl, a former county runner and lacrosse captain, and now member of the college boat club's first eight, for whom life was about seizing opportunities and making the most of her advantages. Those long legs crossed and uncrossed in front of poor old Howard. And yes, the ability to flatter her tutorial partner into doing most of the work. Holly knew she was being manipulated, but it was done in such a charming way that somehow she didn't mind. Sophie was steely, willing to get up for those chilly 6 a.m. starts on the river when most students were still hunkered under the duvets, persuading second years to hand over their essays with no sense that she needed to reciprocate at all. Holly had no doubt that at the end of the 3 years she would have the rowing blue, the future husband, or a potential future husband, and probably, because luck always shone on the likes of her and she would know how to use it, had just scraped 2-1. It would be easy to envy her, perhaps even despise her. And yet Holly couldn't. Sophie represented a world that, even though she might profess to hate it, completely intrigued her. "You know she's a Tory," she grumbled to Alison later, after she'd mentioned to Sophie that she was off to a meeting of the University Labour Party. "Well, of course she is," said Alison. "And she wants to live in a house off the Woodstock Road next year, or in Jericho, not off the Cowley Road like us." "Why would she want to be in East Oxford? Oh, I expect Daddy's buying her a house." "I don't know." She felt suddenly disloyal, thinking of the fragments of conversation that suggested Sophie's father wasn't emotionally attentive, that he lived a quite separate life from his family. "She hasn't mentioned that. Forget I said it." Alison laughed. "You quite like her, really."
Yeah, well, you know, she's not that bad. And she didn't find her bad at all. She would hanker after the snippets of information Sophie dropped about her life, the details of cocktail parties in other college rooms, the casual reference to drugs snorted by school friends elsewhere, though Sophie didn't touch the stuff, was far too preoccupied with being a wholesome, healthy rower. The tales, offered with an eye-rolling boys-will-be-boys tolerance, of the elite drinking societies to which her cousin Hal, a third year in a different college, belonged. "You won't believe what they got up to last weekend," she whispered, and Holly wondered if there was an element of her that loved scandalizing her friend with the extravagance of the upper classes. "What?" Holly's stomach tightened in anticipation at a tale that promised to be more bride's head than anything she could imagine. These stories told in a breathless hurry amid a run of giggles were like the opening of Decline and Fall, with the added thrill of having happened in real life. "The Libertines were at a lunch at Brooks on Turl Street, and when they were finished, each of them ordered a separate taxi to take them down to the King's Arms." "But that's a minute's walk away." She was befuddled. "Exactly. A fleet of taxis queuing the length of Turl Street, each waiting for a minute's ride." "Weren't the taxi drivers annoyed?" "They were each paid £50. 50 quid's not bad for a minute's job." "I'm sure they were fine." Sophie sounded airy. "But they might have felt stupid." "Oh, come on, who cares? They did their job and were paid for it. Oh, God, sometimes you're so serious." She gathered her books in one swift movement that suggested the issue was closed, and stood looking at Holly, still busy imagining the bemused taxi drivers. "Come on." Her voice was tight with irritation. "We'll be late." And so Holly trailed after her, reproaching herself for the crime of being insufficiently light-hearted, of failing to see the funny side in a group of indulged young men flaunting their privilege, agonizing over why she detested this sort of behavior, but still continued to be seduced by Sophie and the world she seemed to represent. She stumbled down the worn wooden steps from the library and into Old Quad, Sophie several strides ahead of her now, obviously displeased and apparently shaking her off before the tutorial, where she would rely on her translation and revert to being all sweetness and light. By the porter's gate, Sophie stopped and smiled up at a tall young man, a boatie from another college, one good at rowing, perhaps Oriel or Christchurch. He seemed to know Holly's tutorial partner, and bent down to give her a double kiss, one on each cheek. The light flooding into the quad glanced off his thick hair, which flopped into his eyes and his sharp cheekbones, illuminating his face so that Holly could see the curve of his mouth and his green and gold-flecked eyes. His shoulders, tapering to a slim waist, were those of a rower, and when he laughed, as he was doing now at something Sophie said, the tone was rich but not braying. It spoke of class more than money, and of an innate but not grating self-confidence. "Who was that?" she asked Sophie later as they waited on the landing outside Howard's room, and her friend watched this Adonis walk across the quad to leave the college. At the porter's gate he turned and looked up. "Oh, that," Sophie said, her eyes feasting on him, though her tone suggested her feelings were terribly casual. "That was James Whitehouse." Chapter 10, Autumn 1992. Holly's heart hammered thick and fast as she leaned against the tree trunk. 7 a.m. and her breath rose through the early morning mist and beaded into moisture that clung to each stark branch. Her chest hurt. She had managed this run 4 times this week, and it wasn't getting any easier. Her body wasn't used to pushing itself, games being something she'd shirked as much as possible, her scholarliness a creditable excuse. "Well, I suppose you could miss it to prepare for your Oxford exam," Mrs. Thorogood had said, and her exclusion had become permanent, for her presence on the netball pitch contributed little,
and was never sought by the team that was burdened with her. Now, though, she was paying for that slothfulness. Her face, she knew, was a shiny red, and there was sweat clagging beneath her bra straps and dampening her armpits. Even more of a reason to hide away. They hadn't come past yet, the men's first eight, and she'd make sure she was well on her way or hidden back from the path when they did. The fear of being seen was the only thing that drove her on, that prevented her from collapsing in a pile on the grass where her body so clearly wanted to give up. Of course, to prevent detection, she could just run slowly back to the college, face turned downward, waving through the smallest passages in the hope of seeing no one. But then she wouldn't see them. She wouldn't see him. A voice in a megaphone. The rhythmic slick of oars on water. The hum of a bicycle strumming the towpath. She sprang back, like one of the does in Walsingham College Deer Park, though in damp black leggings and cheap trainers, as ungainly as an overweight 18-year-old could possibly be. She flattened herself against the trunk, watching as the first boat seared past, the epitome of synchronicity and power. Eight young men at the pinnacle of their fitness working in unison, urged on by their cocks and the coach, whose bikes sped alongside them. There was a rhythm and a beauty to what they were doing, their oars sculling the water without a splash, their bodies bending forwards and leaning back in a seamless, continual motion. Even if she wasn't interested in one crew member, the stroke, the leader, the most skilled and competitive, they were a joy to see. She ran on, keeping her distance, though she knew they were too preoccupied to see her, would pay less attention to the floundering fresher who possessed not one item of college sports kit than to the swans who hissed, imperious, from the banks of the Isis, and rose from the water in a flurry of hard-beating wings. At some point the boat would turn and come back, would streak back up towards the boat club, and she would have the chance of watching his face, tense with effort and concentration, as he shifted forwards and leaned back, driving his teammates onwards, setting the pace. She would try to time her running so that she managed to see him before she lumbered back towards where she'd left her bike. Her breath became more ragged, her chest aching as she pushed herself onwards. How to time it so that she would just glimpse him? And then they had sped past, and she was pounding along the sandy path back towards the colleges, a shot of adrenaline searing through her as she reeled from her hit for the day. They would train again tomorrow, and she would be here, though there was a tutorial at 9, and she could feel an essay crisis looming. Still this, seeing him, would power her through, would make her write her essay on sensuality in Middlemarch more sensitively and with more authority. University was about education, but an education gained in so many ways. Sometimes she wondered if she was becoming obsessed, but her behaviour seemed quite in keeping with the feelings of these literary heroines, the physical excitement she felt when she saw him. The way in which her breath grew lighter or her stomach tipped over was what infatuation was about. Even hearing his name was enough to make her feel light-headed. "Oh, really?" she'd say if Sophie mentioned him, and would adopt the casual nonchalance her friend had once shown. She made sure she was never around the two of them, would duck her head on the rare occasions they were together and he entered college, and he was, she was sure, completely oblivious of her. Just once he caught her eye. She was racing to her room and heard footsteps thundering down the stairs from Ned Iddesley Flight's above her. Two pairs. Ned's, from the sound of it, and someone unknown's. They sped past as she reached her door and stood back to let them bound past. "Chairs!" Ned called in passing. "Chairs," she mouthed, as the second figure barged past. "Sorry, sorry." He held both palms up and flashed her a smile, his green eyes emitting warmth and the confidence that he would be forgiven. Of course he would be forgiven. Then bounded ahead without waiting for an answer. "That's all right," she called down the stairs. Her voice sounded high-pitched, weak and ineffectual as it petered down the staircase. She waited, but there was no reply. Things could have become trickier when Sophie became involved with him. Seeing him was how she rather coyly put it, for no one would ever claim to be going out with James Whitehouse. It wasn't just that he wasn't the kind of young man who could ever be possessed by anyone. It was also that no one wanted to appear less than cool. In fact, their relationship made things easier. He rarely came to college, except late at night, and so there was no risk of being seen, of her infatuation being guessed at. And yet Sophie couldn't resist confiding in her, hinting at her insecurities, seeking reassurance about whether this meant he really liked her, and of course regaling her with the latest exploits of the libertines, of which James was a member, all whispered in the breathy knowledge that she shouldn't really be sharing this, but she was going to do so anyway, all divulged in part out of a desire to shock. Sophie chatted too about the New Year's Eve party she would be throwing at her parents' home in Wiltshire while they were in London. James, she very much hoped, would be going, and the set she hung out with in college. Girls studying classics and history of art, who came from the same sort of background. Fathers in banking, houses in the country, ponies and tennis lessons, skiing holidays, a private education culminating in boarding for the sixth form at a good public school. Holly had nothing against Alex, Jules or Kat, was sure they were perfectly nice, though they'd made little effort to be friendly to her. She didn't expect to be invited. And yet, it smarted as the term progressed, and it became increasingly clear she wouldn't be. She waited, half hoping that the issue might be raised. But as the details changed from a party to a dinner party, she realised she'd never even been considered. Should she raise it as a joke? And then she imagined Sophie's pity. Oh, sorry, it didn't occur to me you'd want to come. Or even more bluntly, oh, Holly, it's not your sort of thing at all. As the term raced to its end, she realised that she'd entered into an unspoken contract with this girl, who both entranced and appalled her. She would increasingly shoulder the workload, do the weekly translation and make notes for the essay that she would photocopy at the newsagents in Hollywell Street. And in return, Sophie would allow her to vicariously experience her life. And that was fine. The casual kindness was enough. The requests for reassurance, the snippets of gossip, the acknowledgement of her across a packed dining hall with a kind of radiant smile that stopped her in her tracks and that warmed her. That said that even if she wasn't the right type, she was a friend of sorts. And then, one evening, she came across them both in the gateway to the college and managed a hello, the syllables thick in her throat so that she almost had to cough them up. She barely looked at him, was just aware of his presence, his broad shoulders in a charcoal wool jacket, not his rowing kit, for they were going to dinner, collar turned up, framing the hint of a smile. She smiled at her friend, her face flushing as she mumbled some nonsense about needing to find a book in a pigeonhole and quickly ducked out of sight. "Who was that?" she heard him ask Sophie, as she busied herself in the porter's lodge, searching for the non-existent hardback. She waited, her ears straining to hear her answer, avoiding the porter's eye. "Oh, that," said Sophie. "Just my tutorial partner. No one important." And she took James's arm, clinging to it as if she was a delicate specimen who needed protecting, and swept off into the night.
Chapter 11. Sophie. The 13th of December, 2016. Court 2 of the Old Bailey is not as Sophie imagined it. She had anticipated something intimidating and impressive, not this tawny oak-panelled room that looks distinctly shabby, as if its glory days are long past. She can barely believe she is here, in these surroundings that remind her of the Commons, the same poison-green leather on the seats emblazoned with gold, the same wood, forming 5 sturdy thrones and a crest, the same nod to past grandeur, glimpsed in the carved wooden wreaths of flowers and grapes, coated in dust that drape above each door. She perches on the edge of a bench, high up in the public gallery, and tries to distract herself from the fact that her husband is sitting in the dock below, flanked by a security officer, showcased behind sheets of bulletproof glass. He looks vulnerable from this angle, his shoulders as broad as ever, but his hair thinning just a touch at the top, she notices for the first time. A wave of fear ambushes her. Her knees begin to quiver, and she puts her palms down on them firmly, hoping that the teenage tourists, glancing at her with frank curiosity, won't wonder why she is quaking. Stupid. Of course they'll guess. She places her handbag, x-rayed, opened, pawed through, on her knees, and when that doesn't quite stop the juddering, crosses her legs and hugs them close. A loud gurgle from her stomach. She can sense the acid swilling, though she hasn't eaten this morning. Little wonder that she has lost nearly a stone in the 6 weeks since James's arrest. This is only an initial appearance, the plea and trial preparation hearing. So how emaciated will she look by the trial next year? She swallows, trying to dislodge the sharp plumb of pain in her throat. She could wail. She, the most calm and controlled of individuals, who was brought up to temper any unpleasant feelings with dry humour, or to keep them firmly suppressed. Her insides have hollowed out, and a potent bank of emotions presses up. Horror, incredulity, revulsion, and above all a deep, all-encompassing shame. She clamps her lips tight. It frightens her, this intensity of feeling. Only once before has she experienced anything similar, and then it was a shadow of this. She dabs at her eyes with a tissue. Letting her emotions overwhelm her isn't an option. She has the children to think about, and, of course, James. But she knows now, with a certainty that she hadn't before today, that she can't attend each day of the trial. Just running the gauntlet of the photographers outside the court has shown her that she couldn't. Maintaining her smile while James's fingers almost crushed hers, his fist such a clamp of iron she nearly winced. She had sensed his nerves then, something he hasn't admitted to, even in the still quiet moments of the night when she lets herself shift into the warmth pooling from him in bed and whisper, "Are you okay?" He hasn't shown a chink of vulnerability since being charged, nor has he raised the possibility of being convicted. If they don't speak of it, perhaps it cannot happen. And it has seemed so far-fetched. That cliché, a living nightmare. It all feels very real now. As solid as the sturdy oak that stretches everywhere. The witness box, the jury benches, the judge's bench, the counsel's row, upon which James's barrister, a stout, somewhat formidable woman called Angela Regan, and the prosecuting QC, a Miss Woodcroft, are piling lever-arch file after lever-arch file of evidence. Her husband will stand trial for rape. She tastes the squat word, ugly, like the offence itself. She knows it is happening, and yet, despite the reality forcing its way upon her as she stares down at him in the dock, as she drinks in the details of the court, the patrician gaze of the judge who, in her normal life, she could imagine talking to at a drinks party, it still doesn't make sense. He is innocent. Of course he is innocent. She knows that. Has known it ever since that terrible Tuesday when he was arrested. She knows all the flaws in his personality, and he could never be capable of this. So how has the situation escalated this far? She thinks of recent party investigations, one presided over by a lawyer, who'd been at school with James and Tom, the other by a friend from Oxford, men who could provide a pattern of independence and still guarantee the right conclusion. And she wonders why that couldn't have happened in this case. Tom owes him. Oh, how he owes him. But once the police were involved, even the Prime Minister's close friendship, those ties that have bound them for over 30 years, haven't been tight enough to protect him. "So if we can agree on that week in April..." James's QC, Miss Regan, cuts through her thoughts, her voice with its Belfast accent, an almost masculine gravel. She and the judge are referring to the housekeeping, as if James's case is something to be tidied away. The hearing seems to be coming to an end. There is a date set for April. Bail is confirmed. And now John Vesty, James's solicitor, is pushing back his seat and allowing himself to smile as he whispers something to the QC. Sophie stares up at the ceiling as they gather their documents.